Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today we speak with Theodore L., plus the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news and events around the region. For ArtSound FM Community Radio, I'm Peter Searles. Theodore L. studied literature and modern languages at the University of Sydney, then spent time in Florence conducting archival research, and was awarded a PhD in 2010. He worked as a freelance editor, translator, and researcher, and published A Voice in the Fire in 2015, a study of some little-known Italian anti-fascist writing. While Theodore L. and his wife were in Beirut, Lebanon, where she was on a diplomatic posting, they survived the massive port explosion of August 2020. After they had settled back in Canberra, his essay about that event, Facades of Lebanon, won the prestigious 2021 Caliber Essay Prize. L's non-fiction and translations have appeared in Australia, Italy, and the United Kingdom. He is an honorary lecturer in literature at the Australian National University. Theodore L's 2022 collection From Recent Work Press, Beginning in Sight, was co-winner of the 2022 Anne Elder Award for a first poetry collection. Let's hear him read one poem in the collection that he says has a special place in his output. Whitsunday Passage describes an experience that led him to realise he had the makings of a poet and would not continue as only a literary essayist and academic.
Whitsunday Passage. Where, wearing love's cast-offs and dreading all faces, once ever, I wished not to be saved from poetry. The shielding stance of the waves, ushering islands away. Slender hands, blue veins beneath those shining robes, leading emigre mountains, arms around their offspring, towards the vanishing line, where broken spray glimmers sometimes, beckons from past the edge, the rumoured mazes of the reef. Distant laughter. Beside me, mute sands, sleepless, altering their shapes, drifting in the end and wading out for the disbanding of years, its beginning in sight.
Of that poem, Theodore L. says,
it's one of the smaller, shorter poems, somewhat out of the way in the collection, but it is intimately connected with the experience that pricked me into wanting to do more.
He says that after his bachelor's degree at the University of Sydney,
what happened was I had my heart broken by my first serious girlfriend in really quite painful circumstances and difficult circumstances. And the experience was so overwhelming that it left me. I now know all these years later I actually have a depressive condition which is treated and it's all in hand. But at the time I didn't know that, and it cast a long shadow. And some 6 months later, I was sitting of all places next just on a wharf near Luna Park in Sydney, where I was going to meet some friends for breakfast one morning. And I was sitting there with the Harbour Bridge and the Opera House across the water and ships going by. And I thought, this scene, this wants me to say something about it. This wants me to start putting words on a page. I was going to uni that day, and so I had a notebook. And so I started to just describe what I was seeing, and it wanted to lineate. It didn't want to be prose. It wanted to come out in lines of free verse, some longer, some shorter, and it wanted to be captured in straightforward declarative statements, which were also images, and it wanted to it was as though the scene was connecting with the underlying sadness I was still grappling with. That's right. The key to it was that day was also my 22nd birthday. Mm. And I felt suddenly there was this nexus, if you will, of layers of meaning and an impulse to start writing.
That poem isn't one he would want to make public now, he says, but Whitsunday Passage refers back to his experiencing a clear impulse to write in that way. Let's listen to it again.
Whitsunday Passage. Where, wearing love's cast-offs and dreading all faces, once ever, I wished not to be saved from poetry. The shielding stance of the waves, ushering islands away. Slender hands, blue veins beneath those shining robes, leading emigre mountains, arms around their offspring, towards the vanishing line, where broken spray glimmers sometimes, beckons from past the edge, the rumoured mazes of the reef, a distant laughter, beside me, mute sands, sleepless, altering their shapes, drifting in the end and wading out for the disbanding of years, its beginning in sight.
There are some different registers there. There's the shock of what you've seen, the personal and the inhabiting words, which strikes me as being very important to your poetry. Mm-hmm. There's a sort of inhabiting that takes some work to figure out how it's working, what's working.
It does strike me too, as I listen to you talk, that is your poetry is usually, at least in this book, it's a series of images, and you're inviting through the lines. It's like you're pulling the reader in to see what you see.
Oh, well, if it comes across that way, I'm very glad, because that is the basic impulse, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
There's another layer to it, which is the use of compound images to create a narrative, to create a narrative flow. That is a much newer thing for me to have tried. It's in this book, especially in the series of three poems called Generators, but that's a later stage. The shorter, more intense poems are very much, if you like, the bread and butter of how I felt I started to want writing and how I went about writing poetry for many, many years. There are a number of poems in this book which are, you could describe them as melancholy, but my aim in the book was to rise out of that, through it and from it, but eventually out of it. Mm-hmm. But it is sort of where it all starts, I guess. Mm.
Deploying that range of moods in Beginning in Sight has an end goal, he says.
The poems often have a social aspect and a hope for better things, and they often are social, cultural even, things. And yet one does have a strong sense of your aloneness, because there's such an individuality of your perception.
Yeah. At some point when I was reading this, I thought, there aren't a lot of people here. This is the internal and the external sort of reckoning with each other.
But there's a lot of people inferred, interestingly,
sure.
Always. I think a lot of your poems do have an impulse of providing hope or voicing hope, and it's not just for yourself.
Well, I suppose, yes, you're right. There are not a lot of people here. And that is something that became clear to me after a while, having written a lot of these poems. What's really going on, and what allowed me sort of to put a frame around these poems and put them between the covers and say this is a book, is the fact that these poems are all together, that they're a cumulative reckoning, if you like, with about 10 years or so of life experience, where I was trying to find myself as a writer, trying to find myself as an adult, trying to find a way in the world, trying to find a job, because there were years that went by when I was working freelance as an editor, loving very much the type of work that I was doing, but it was only ever a stopgap measure, and I was living at home with my parents for I moved home with them for what was going to be, I hope, sort of 3 or 4 months while I just got things sorted out, and then I'd rent a place. It turned into 4 years. Now, I mean, I love my parents, and it was wonderful to be with them and to, you know, have a roof over your head and 3 meals a day, of course. But what I was trying to do was, you know, get on and have a career of some kind. I've been lucky enough to have had wonderful friends for so many years, but as I'm an only child, and it was a strange period of being oddly isolated, of working as an editor, co-editing a journal, which I absolutely love to do, coordinating a lot of other people's work, and having
what was that journal?
Contrapasso magazine, which my friend Matthew Asprey Gear, who's a writer, actually, he came up with the idea, but he wanted to do it with someone. He wanted, as he called it, a partner in crime. And because I was working a lot with poets and on poetry, he asked me if I'd be the poetry editor. So I was. And I ended up doing a lot of the management work for the journal as well, over the years that we did it. So there I was, sort of in the mix with a lot of people, a lot of wonderful people, many of whom are still great friends, very imaginative, intelligent, creative people. And yet I felt alone a lot of the time, which is paradoxical. And a lot of these poems were written extremely slowly, over periods of months, some of them, in that time of around between 2010 and 2015, when this was what life was like. And they are, a very good friend of mine, the writer and critic B.J. Silcox, describes them as puzzle boxes. I hadn't thought of them that way before, but she was right. They are quite intricate, some of them, and they're attempts to work out a position. They started often with a setting and an atmosphere and a mood, a bit like a cloud, which then would take a very long time sometimes to condense into words and into lines and imagery. A few of them started from a form of words, a line or a phrase, which would just insist. I'll have an idea, a phrase will insist, and I'll just jot it down and get it there. And I won't know what to do with it sometimes for years. So that Whitsunday Passage, the one I just read, was one of those, because Whitsunday Passage in the Whitsunday Islands was where the heartbreak happened. And I always thought, well, that setting, that place, that atmosphere, that there's a weight there that wants to drop. But I can't find the words for it. And it took a very long time before that all coalesced and condensed into concrete shape. Sunshower. Late in the year, a lifted blind let in reunions, light beating on the leaves. A likeness had come over the days to forerunners peopled with smaller shadows, as though old friends were coming home to bargain for extensions on the past, make disclosures from before the crowding out of life. Hesitant warmth in light of words that left their handprints on the mirror. Pressure to tread lightly on the grass spears, barefoot even. There was recovery in the turf, though a soul could best what the drought had not. Then the clouds, encountering errors, thinned away. Not the peace we were preparing for, though perhaps a truce with silence, a noon for me, a keepsake.
You were saying that you had a sense that you were searching for something. You were doing things that most people would be quite impressed by. The Contrapasso, I think it was a journal of international literature.
That's right.
You were studying, you went on to gain a PhD. It was in an unusual subject about an unusual group of writers in Italy and so forth, and which we'll get you to talk a bit about that too. But I guess what you're talking about is you hadn't quite assumed to be a poet yet.
No, I hadn't. I hadn't at all. I was among poets and other kinds of writers, and I had the writing I was doing mainly in those 5 years, 2010 to 2015. Actually, going back to 2007 which was when I started the PhD. So that makes 8 years. The vast majority of writing I'd been doing was nonfiction, academic nonfiction, research papers, my thesis, the book that then came out of the thesis. And I loved that subject. And I had the great luck that my professor, Paolo Bartoloni, had sort of put this group of writers my way. And they're not hugely well known in Italy, not very, very widely written about, and certainly less so in English. But that, to me, meant there was all to play for and there was all to do. It was really, I had been lucky enough to find a subject that, once again, it wanted to be written about. Yeah. And I got to go over to Italy and dig through archives and find things out. It was marvellous. But I had not thought of myself as being a poet, no.
That group of writers was, in a sense, waiting to be found.
In a sense, I mean, yes, they're not completely unknown, of course. Particularly in Florence, which is where they were mainly centred from the 1930s to the 1990s and early 2000s, when they eventually one by one, most of them lived into very old age. Actually, they were known a little in English, and I'm glad to have done something to advance that.
Would you name some of the poets?
Piero Bigongiari was the one on whom I did most work and on whom I wrote my thesis and the book. Mm. And I have translated some of his work here and there. Maybe another strand to the story is Lebanon, where I lived for some years, and I had done some more work on Bigongiari in the time there, but it got destroyed in Lebanon for reasons. Yeah. We'll talk about. So Piero Bigongiari was one. Mario Luzzi was another. He was probably the best known of all this group in his time. He was often sort of hints were dropped that Luzzi might win the Nobel Prize one day. And I wish that he had, actually, but he never did. It's just one of those things. And the third in this, and it is a group of three at the centre, is Alessandro Parronchi, who's probably better known in Italy as an art historian, but was a very fine poet himself. And if listeners know Italian poetry, there's a great poet who did win the Nobel Prize, Eugenio Montale, who won it in 1975. And he was a generation older than them, and he was kind of a mentor to them in Florence. They're similar in that they write in the lyric mode, and they have placed great emphasis on the music of Italian and the gentle music of Italian. But they're also quite distinct, so that Mario Luzzi is an inheritor of the poetry of the Middle Ages, really, because his poetry, even the settings of his poetry, are the landscapes of the country around Siena and the medieval gold background paintings. Mm-hmm. And his style is very lyrical, but also quite disciplined, as Dante could be, or mm-hmm. Guido Cavalcanti can be. Piero Bigongiari, whom I worked on, is very, very different. Writes mainly in free verse, could be rather slapdash in his style sometimes, actually, and was prolific. He wrote all the time, practically every day.
Like Neruda.
Neruda. Yes, and actually, rather like Neruda and some of the Spanish language poets, Bigongiari is rather sort of can be very fantastical, dreamlike. Mm. Dreamlike and sometimes rather weird. A professor, I heard once heard a professor say about Bigongiari's first book, which he wrote when he was about 25. This professor said, non si capisce nulla, don't understand a thing. But I found a lot in Bigongiari that was really intriguing, because he put dates, after a certain point, he put dates to his poems and published them in chronological order.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so what you can do is follow motifs. Yeah. He's like a composer, you know, we'll drop this, put this motif here, and then it'll come back 3 years later, but be combined with other motifs and have a different meaning.
Interesting.
And Parronchi, to round out the picture, is more of an impressionist, more sort of gentle, just dropping little hints, little pebbles in the water.
Those were the subject of your dissertation and the book that you then published, A Voice in the Fire, Piero Bigongiari's Poetry of War and Survival from 2015.
Yes, that's...
Who published that?
Troubadour Italian Studies, which is Troubadour is a British publisher, and they have an Italian Studies academic list.
Right. Very cool.
At one point you're embarked on a study of the history of the sonnet. Is that still happening?
That's still happening. That's in the background. That's
that makes perfect sense, right, with Petrarch. Yes. I mean, the starting point.
Ah, right? Well, he's not quite the starting point. Well, he's the
starting point in the general imagination.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
The starting point, you know, in the literal sense, was a poet called Giacomo da Lentini from Sicily. Now, the history of the sonnet, now this is it's the project that is always just about starting, because I have so many other things going on that it has to trickle along in the background. But the idea is to hunt out as many sonnets as I possibly can from the time of Giacomo da Lentini up to sort of the High Renaissance, up to maybe about...
Can you
about,
put a year on da Lentini or an era?
Yes, late 1200s, early 1300s. Okay. And go up to about the late 1600s. I haven't put a finishing date to it yet. But just to compile an anthology of translations, because I've discovered, I think, that book doesn't exist. But the sonnet was then inherited by British and French and all other cultures. And anthologies of English sonnets are, you know, very widespread, but not the Italian origins.
Sure. I love the sonnet. So I teach it a lot. And I always joke, you know, generally when I teach it, I start with Petrarch just because it's a condensed. And I say, you know, if just imagine if Laura had returned, if it had not been unrequited, you know, would we have the sonnet? You know, whoa. And I joke, he took one for the team, you know.
you could say that. It's a bit like asking what would have happened if Beatrice had not died.
Right.
Would she have led Dante to paradise?
Exactly. I mean, all the suffering, but in the really huge picture.
Yes. Yes.
You know.
Philip Larkin jumping centuries ahead. Notorious curmudgeon. And so many of his poems appear deeply negative, but writing a poem's never negative.
No,
it's never.
An optimistic act, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, which goes completely. back to what Peter was saying about. Well, I certainly hope that my poems here are not despairing, are about melancholy situations. The aim is redress.
As Theodore L. has related here, to arrive at a strikingly idiosyncratic style of his own, he has looked far afield, back centuries and decades. He also cites two other modern poets as major influences. One is Robert Gray, an Australian poet praised as an imagist without a rival in the English-speaking world.
Robert Gray, yes. There is another poet in a similar vein, actually, sadly no longer with us, the Swedish poet Thomas Tranström. Oh,
he's one of the best.
Oh, absolutely.
He did win the Nobel, right?
He did,
yeah.
He did. And that's how I found out about him. I'd never heard of him before. Mm. What appealed then and still appeals now about Tranström and about Robert Gray as well is the constant sense of concentration, the extreme concentration of images. In Tranström, there's one habit or tick or little bit of style that I've picked up. It's a way of... he'll start describing a scene and then almost out of context there'll be an unrelated image. He'll add something. But he'll do it in a way that makes it feel like he's just thought of it. He'll say, the garden in spring, oh, that thing, that object, that image, that memory. And so, to pick a poem at random, although in this case... the poem is sent, C-E-N-T. I do it in the opposite way. I describe an effect and then I say what it's referring to. The scuttle of slim bronze under the tall counter. That lost coin. So that is, for me, is pure Tranström.
Mm.
But except in reverse. Because I start with the effect and then I refer it to what it is. And there are many that's and those's and these's. Scent. The scuttle of slim bronze under the tall counter. That lost coin, fumbled from your pocket like its minted glider from the nest hole into airspace. Scents taught ecology. Two gliders equaled one parading frill neck. Specimens now. And citizenship. Her Majesty had a profile smaller than your fingernail. Spotting a scent blinking up past your scuffed knees made you smile like someone with a crush. It would always buy a chocolate its own size. The bellied jars of parti-coloured swirls surely forecast silos full of justice. That was before hunger. Life then was all in small denominations. Nothing was zeroed.
I always love when I come upon a line and that just a single line makes me go, wow. And the penultimate line here, that was before hunger, sojura. Life was then all enjambment in small denominations. Oh, like that's when I'm reading a poem or hearing it, that I savor that.
Oh, it's I'm just delighted.
A small but brilliant moment.
Well, that's extremely kind of you. When I wrote that and looked at it, I thought, oh, that's almost glaring.
No.
Because it was almost glaring, caesura and enjambment, because I try not to draw attention to these things in the structure. I feel like I've smuggled them in almost.
Right, no. But and I think the poem is very well, this sounds so nerdy. It's very well punctuated, and I mean that in the truest sense, like in this sense that the punctuation is really guiding it and we're trusting it. So we've given over to it at that point.
Oh,
and
glad.
So it can be a surprise.
This is a debt I owe to Tranströmer, because he is an absolute master of the pauses and of the gentle moments of sort of guiding the reader to say, watch this, look at this, and move here, then move there.
Next week, we'll continue our conversation with Canberra-based poet Theodore L. We'll talk more about his 2022 volume, Beginning in Sight, as well as about his experience of living through the cataclysmic 2020 explosion in the port of Beirut, Lebanon. For ArtSound FM's Poetry on the Radio, I'm Peter Searles.
The Rhyming Bugle. The 2024 ACT Book of the Year Award is open for nominations. Offered by the ACT government, it has a prize of $10,000 for the winner, $2,000 for any highly commended book, and $1,000 for each shortlisted book. It's open to books by authors who reside in the ACT or who can demonstrate an ACT-based arts practice. Nominations close at 5 p.m. on Thursday, March 28, via the online Arts ACT Grants portal. The Prime Minister's Literary Awards, an annual award honouring books published in the previous calendar year, is accepting entries, but only until Tuesday, March 19 at 3 p.m. Established in 2008, and now the richest literary prize in the nation with a tax-free prize pool of $600,000, the Prime Minister's Literary Awards have six categories, including poetry. A shortlist will be announced in July, and the winning books in September. Go to creative.gov.au and search for Prime Minister's Literary Awards 2024. On Monday, March 18 at Smith's Alternative in Civic, Recent Work Press presents Jen Webb and Jackie Malins. Jen Webb is a writer and cultural theorist and distinguished professor of creative writing at the University of Canberra. She writes poetry, researches creative practice, and makes and exhibits artist books. She will read from her new collection, The Daily News. Jackie Malins is a Canberra-based performance poet, artist, and arts organiser whose first poetry collection, F Words, was published in 2021 by Recent Work Press. On March 25 at Smith's Alternative, That Poetry Thing presents Angie Contini and Maya Brown. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly in the studios of ArtSound FM in Canberra on unceded traditional land. Hosts Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles create the program with producer Peter Monaghan. Poetry on the Radio is heard each Sunday at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope, performed by the Atrium Musica de Madrid.